Chuck, why the Air Force?
I just say I've always been interested in flying since I was just a little kid. And as it turns out, I can kind of pinpoint the time that I decided I really wanted to fly fighters. And it was a movie called Fighter Squadron, Evan O'Brien and Robert Stack. And that was when I was in fourth grade. And I saw that, and it really convinced me that that's really kind of wanted to do. And I had an uncle who was a pilot, and he flew in World War II and also in Korea. And he kind of solidified that that desire. He took me for a ride in one of his planes there back in Pennsylvania. And so just kind of went from there.
And how old were you when you joined?
The Air Force? Well, let's see. I went to the Academy. I was born in 39. Went to the Academy in 59, so I was 20.
And what was it that experience like? Had you ever left home? Had you had experience with that before?
I went to Penn State for 2 years, studied aeronautical engineering after graduating from high school. So I had been away, if you will, for quite some time, off and on. And going to the Air Force Academy was a different animal because I was gone 1 full year. We weren't allowed to go home for 1 year. But there was plenty to keep your attention. It was overall probably the toughest 4 years I've ever had. A lot of pressure, constantly being evaluated, and there's just really no time off. And I can say the Air Force Academy is certainly not a party school. And after the been to the Academy, they took 14 of us after graduated, and they sent us to Purdue for one summer session and one fall semester, and we got our master's degree in astronautics. I think the intent was they were going to move us into the astronaut stream, if you will, but life kind of got in the way and called Vietnam, and they kind of scattered us to the four winds, and that kind of fell through. So,
did you have any memorable moments from the training?
From
the training, at the academy, any memorable moments from that?
Oh, probably the most memorable moment is the fact that I met my future wife there. It was a Thanksgiving dance the first semester, and she was really kind of dating my roommate. They were from the same hometown in Olathe, Kansas, and I kind of wandered over to the dance and sat down with my roommate and a couple other guys and just kind of struck up a conversation and kind of just went from there. In the winter semester, the following January, I had to go to the hospital for 2 months up at Denver, and Fitzsimmons Army Hospital. I had to have a knee operation, and of course, she was going to school at Colorado Women's College, and gave her a call and was able to solidify our friendship, let's put it that way, and things just kind of went from there.
What year would that have been?
60.
Do you remember where you were when you received word that Vietnam had essentially started?
No. It was one of those things that just built up gradually. And we come to understand and accept the fact that we were all going to take our turn. And my turn came, went over in 68. In fact, I was on the flight over on New Year's Day, New Year's Eve in 68, and went to the Philippines and got adjusted there, and then we deployed over to Benoit. And so I was stuck there when the 68 offensive, Tet Offensive occurred. And as it turns out, I was on alert that night, and on the Ready 5 alert line, and 2 o'clock in the morning is when they started the bombardment with rockets. And things just kind of went from bad to worse. I do remember that I was really thankful for the Cobra gunships that the Army had. Things got pretty bad because they invaded the base on the east end, which was where we were located, and they kind of broke open the army, if you will, and passed out M16s, and I had never seen M16 before, a rifle. We carried pistols. But I had a very steep learning curve. They didn't tell me a whole lot about it one time through, and I understood that. And we were kind of part of the base defense, the perimeter defense. And the Cobra gunships started out shooting at the enemy as they were coming in out in front of us. And about 2 hours later, pardon me, the gunships were behind us shooting. So you can tell that the Viet Cong and NVA had proceeded to come in the perimeter. But they were stopped, and they actually flushed us out of there that afternoon, evening, and we went to Thailand. And because we couldn't serve anything productive there at Ben Wall, we were pretty well contained. And so we sat for a week or so in Thailand, and we came back after things had cooled down, things were under control there at Ben Wall.
And when you returned, how long did you stay in Ben Wall?
Well, we stayed off and on anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months at a time. And then we would go back to Clark for maybe a week or two, and then deploy back to Ben Wall. We also had a base up in Yudorn, Thailand, which is where we flew our missions into North Vietnam from there. So.
It's been said throughout the history books that the Tet Offensive was really kind of the height of the Vietnam War. From your perspective, how did the Tet Offensive influence what came after?
Well, what came after was kind of a mopping up operation, because we had really hurt them bad, although the media didn't see it quite that way. And it was just kind of a gradual escalation of operations against the Viet Cong and the NVA and up to Hanoi and the targets around there. So it just seemed to drag on and on, though. It just seemed it would never end, hitting the same targets, you know, day after day, and didn't seem to see making a lot of progress. But did what you could and did what you had to do. So,
did you have any other close encounters?
We were escorting some B-52s one night, and we got into it, and with the surface-to-air missiles, and even some MiGs came down and tapped us, and that was when I had the encounter with the MiG, kind of a head-to-head, but he was bunk on small target. I couldn't see him to lock on. But he had a gun, and that's what happened with the windscreen here. One bullet didn't come in, just glanced off. So.
Well, many people can't see, but you have a coffee table here of the glass that, and correct me if I'm wrong, was near the front of the plane.
Yeah, windscreen up front. Yeah.
And a bullet hit it. Mm-hmm. So describe that moment and what it sounded like and what was going through your mind.
Well, it was a loud crack, and going through my mind was getting out of there, and which we did right smartly. And the MiG didn't hang around. The MiG-21s was a hit and slash through. They didn't get into a turning fight with him because they were dead pretty fast and we didn't turn real well. But it certainly made you sit up and take notice, and between sweaty palms and dry mouth, we made it back okay.
And they told you if you made it back that you could keep it.
You bet.
And do you remember where you were when you were notified that you would be able to leave Vietnam?
Where I was, well, we knew when the tour would be, wouldn't be complete, and so it was just a matter of administratively following all you need to do to out-process. There was nothing, you know, remarkable about it. It was just kind of a run-of-the-mill, another assignment after Vietnam. So,
how long from the Tet Offensive to the moment when you were able to leave, how long was that time span?
Let's see. Tet Offensive was in January, February of 68, and we left, I think it was the fall of 70.
Yeah. So we skipped a couple of years in there.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to add about your time in Vietnam?
Well, there was a lot of time away from home. Being in the air defense business, they spread us out pretty thin. Between the deployments at Benoit and Udorn, when the Pueblo was captured, they sent us up to Suwon, Korea, and we patrolled the DMZ up there. And that was also, and I think that was 68 as well, if memory serves me right. And then when the EC-121 was shut down in the Taiwan Straits, they sent us up to Tainan, Taiwan, and we patrolled the Straits. So we had a lot of detachments to man, and so we weren't home a whole heck of a lot.
How many hours a day would you say that you spent on patrol or working?
Well, we'd pull 24-hour duty, and then you'd be on alert. Well, you're on alert for 24 hours, and then you'd, pardon me, the next day you'd probably fly a patrol for maybe two patrols, a couple hours apiece.
I've always wondered how a person is able to get through so many hours without sleep and little sleep, no sleep.
Well, we were allowed to sleep as far as that goes. But of course, you're always on call 24 hours, and if you were called to fly, you went pretty quick. But that didn't happen real frequently.
Were you married at the time?
Yeah.
Did you have any kids at that time, or just
two
kids?
Two boys, yep.
And do you remember coming back to the United States?
Yeah.
Did you come from Vietnam back to the United States?
Yeah, we stopped off at Hawaii for a week with the family, and came on back. And one thing they told us is not like now. They said when you get back, you get out of uniform as quickly as you can, because people aren't real happy to see you. And we did. Nobody spit on us or anything like that, but we were warned that, you know, that could happen. So we just kind of left the port of entry real quick and went to my new assignment.
Well, and what was your new assignment? Obviously, your military career didn't stop there.
No, let's see. I was, at that time, I was came back and was going to be an instructor pilot at Vance Field down here in Eden, Oklahoma. And we drove back from California, and I only spent about a year and a half as an instructor pilot, and then they needed 102 pilots, and so I got a by name assignment called back to Iceland. So, and as it turns out, that a lot of the folks that went there at that time were part of the unit that we came from in Vietnam. The flight, in fact, there was a number of people that from the same flight that went back to the squadron in Iceland. So that was it. That was really nice. Yeah.
How many years did you spend in Iceland?
Off and on, 7 years, 7.5 years. Yeah.
And that's where you raised your family and a lot of the growing up of the children?
Yeah, they identify real strongly with Iceland. We enjoyed it up there, as a matter of fact. It was doing a job that I was trained to do, and that was intercept Soviet bombers. And in about 7.5 years I was up there, I probably intercepted about 50. Regarding the Soviet bombers, they were pretty planful back then, and we were up there. And we were in the southwest corner of the island, and the bombers, when they came down, from North Cape around Norway, they would come down and shoot the gap between Iceland and Norway, and we go out and intercept them. We get out pretty far, you know, maybe 350 miles or so from the base, and if you got much further out than that, we'd duck into Scotland to recover, and that's a long trip, and we had some really close calls with the fuel. You had to really manage your fuel because you only had on board what you took off with. We didn't have the capability to refuel then. We did change over eventually to the EF-4, and we were able to have a tanker available if we really needed it. And so we didn't really go to Scotland, and they'd come out and refuel us and go back home if necessary.
So. And what years would that have been, just to try to get a better timeline that you were in that area?
The Air Force? Probably around maybe 75, 80, something like that. 1975, 1980, that time frame.
And what happened after that? Where did you go after that time was up there?
Came back when we left Iceland the last time. We came back and I was stationed at, it was the Air Division at Griffiths Air Force Base up near Rome, New York. And I was the assistant director of operations, and then became the director of operations. And again, it was an air defense posting, and we managed the air defense assets all the way from Maine over around this, the East Coast to Texas. So we had a lot of assets out of GCI sites, and if you will, other and squadrons of fighters as well.
What year was it that you started working with the cadets?
That was after I retired in 89. I was looking for a job for some time before I actually retired, and I just couldn't qualify for much of anything. And so I thought, well, I'll go back and get my teaching certificate and teach some math. I always got along pretty good with math, and so we came back here to the farm and went over to Marshall and went to the college over there and got my teaching certificate. It took about a year, and again I was doing my student teaching in Carrollton, and I thought, well, that would be really a neat place to teach. Now I'm going to try for a job there. I think a job did open up in math, in the math department, but the interview didn't go too good. There was one question, and that was about it. And the principal asked us, well, what do you coach? I said, I don't coach anything. And he says, well, next applicant, and that ended that. And so I got asked around, and someone said, well, why don't you try Wentworth? they might have a spot for you over there. And I didn't know what a Wentworth was, you know, where it was. And I said, well, look for the school over in Lexington with the helicopter in the yard. Okay, I did, walked in and gave him my application, and the secretary took it, and I walked out, was walking out of the office, and she took it into the principal. He came out and said, come here, let's talk. Okay, and so the interview was short again. I mean, this time he said, how's your patience? I said, pretty good. And I said, well, you're hired. And that was the end of that. So I started teaching math in the high school, and then after about a year or two, I went into the college and taught there. And since I was an Air Force Academy graduate, they had a program there of about a half a dozen or so cadets that were in what they called the Falcon program. And that was underwritten by the Falcon Foundation in Colorado Springs, whereby these folks just missed the cutoff for going to the Air Force Academy. And the Academy said, tell you what we'll do. We'll give you a scholarship to go to one of the, I think there were five private military colleges in the States, and for 1 year, and we'll retest you again, and if you pass, why, we'll take you on board. And so that's why I handled that program. I taught them math and handled their administrative requirements. And so I just kind of kept up with that for, I guess, 11 years, and sent some 75 cadets out there that were accepted, which was a neat thing. I like working with those kids. So I take them out in the fall to the academy and hook them up with the Falcons from Wentworth who were out there then, who were in the program. And then in the spring, I take them to the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, to get a look at their heritage. And we enjoyed that real much. That was a great experience. And we still follow them, and we did for quite some time. There are a few that still write to us. My wife baked many thousands of cookies, And as it turns out, when we got a birth announcement, she'd make a quilt for the youngster. So I think she's made some 17 quilts so far. And it's still counting.
So neat.
Yeah.
So you retired from the military, but you didn't really retire because you went on to teach and still kind of stayed in that field. At what point did you finally really retire? Or have you even really retired?
No, I haven't really retired. After 13 years at Wentworth, you know, I figured enough's enough. And traveling back and forth and the teaching kind of lost its luster, if you will. And so I decided, well, I'm just going to hang it up and sit on a farm and do what I need to do around here, which is plenty. So,
what do you think was the most important lesson that you learned in your military career?
Oh, boy. Do what you're told and do the best you can, and everything else take care of itself. So,
well, you served during a time when a lot of people had a lot of opinions about what was going on. Is there anything that you would want my generation or the younger generation to know about your service or about the military in general?
Well, the people in the military are some of the best in the world, and they are very, very dedicated, I know that. And I just want people to remember that. And I think they're doing a lot of that now. They pay attention to what's going on. And the military does foot a lot of responsibility for the defense, and a lot of military folks make a lot of sacrifices, and I think they're being recognized for that, too. So.
Some of the biggest sacrifices have to be with family members, and your family made some sacrifices. You did as well. Talk a little bit about that. Talk about your family.
Well, let's see. I have two boys. One was born in Iceland, and he had to be naturalized, by the way. He was an Icelandic citizen until he was 18 years old, and then he had to choose, but we had to have him naturalized. It was an automatic citizenship, like it is now. Second one was born up there. The first one was born down in Texas, and I was going to one of two school there, Perrin, which is a Sherman Denison area. He went to college at KU, and my number two son went to college at MU. They both really appreciate their family. I know that. And they have strong families, too. In fact, my number one son is married, and he's celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary. We celebrated our 50th this past June. So it's been a good family relationship, and the military was good to us. We appreciated our assignments, tried to make the best of them, and let them know that even though we're moving on again, it's going to be a new place, a new adventure, and they took it all in stride. It was great.
Anything else you want to add?
No, appreciate the interview.